Welcome back to the M&A Zing, a weekly podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders and holdco builders in the UK, Europe and beyond. Today, we are shifting gears slightly to focus on a crucial aspect for business owners, whether they're looking to grow, to acquire, to eventually sell. It's essential that they have a robust financial strategy. And our guest is Tom Griffiths, who is founder of Synergy CFO Solutions. He has over a decade of experience in high finance at JP Morgan, advising some of the world's largest financial institutions. And Tom now applies that formidable expertise to help small and medium-sized businesses to understand their numbers and improve their profits, their cash flow, make data-driven decisions on their path to growth and potentially, ultimately, exit. So Tom, it is great to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me, Gareth. Pleasure to be here.
No, and those finally acute to the podcast ecosystem would have noted that I have also recently been a reciprocal guest on your podcast, Tom, if you want to trail that here.
You have indeed, yeah. So not going to be a duplicative conversation, but yeah, excited to be here and have this conversation with you.
Likewise. So let's get straight into your kind of transition from the big high finance corporate world and into working with SMEs. What was the inspiration moment that encouraged you to transition from that large scale corporate world into founding Synergy CFO Solutions specifically for small business owners?
Good place to start. So I always sort of had a bit of an entrepreneurial itch whilst I was at JP Morgan. And it was really COVID that was the catalyst for me making the decision to leave and kind of leave and start my own thing. And initially, I wasn't really sure what I was going to end up doing. I just knew that it was something entrepreneurial. And so initially, I made the jump, left JP Morgan, and started providing odd bits of consulting, really just kind of whatever came over my desk and people within my network around things like mergers and acquisitions, bits of fundraising, exit planning, odd bits and pieces. And what I realized in that process was that whilst many business owners, they wanted to go and acquire another business, or they wanted to raise money, or they wanted to get, sell their business, and they thought they could do it, within a few months or whatever. And the reality was that underneath, within their own business, there was just a general lack of understanding of what was going on with the numbers. And so I realized that you can't really go and buy and acquire another business if your own business is in a bit of a mess and you can't stay on top of it. You can't raise money if you can't make the financials tell a coherent story. Mm-hmm. You can't sell your business if your finances are a mess. And so I realized that if I could just dial in a process where all I'm essentially doing is helping the business owners understand their numbers so they can see what's working and what's not working in their business and then make better decisions, i.e. data-driven decisions every month, then I was going to be able to help a lot of people. And then once we've got that solid foundation in place, then we can look at the next step, which might be growing through acquisitions, or it could be getting the business ready for sale, or that sort of thing. So that's what led me to this process that I'm now doing, which I'm sure we'll go into a bit more detail on.
Yeah, sure. Well, let's perhaps get into that in more detail. I think it's a very prescient observation, though, that many companies, particularly the small and sort of scale-up type companies that are fast growth, maybe neglect some of those financial essentials in terms of good bookkeeping and properly structured ledgers, etc., because they're head down, drive forward, focus on the growth drivers and maybe don't prioritize the financial housekeeping. You say that's something that you see often, and would you consider it perilous?
Yeah, so I think one of the most common identifiers is really business owners, the thing that tends to ring true is when I say something like lots of business owners make decisions based on how much money is in the bank account, instead of actually reviewing their numbers, understanding what I call the critical four, so revenue, gross profit, net profit, cash, instead of actually understanding those numbers every month or periodically.
Just go to cash.
Just looking at the cash in the bank account and making decisions based off that. But when you make decisions based off the amount of money in the bank account, what ends up happening is you might accidentally spend last year's corporation tax bill that you haven't yet paid, or you might spend this quarter's VAT bill, or you spend money that you needed to use for paying a marketing agency for something else. And then what happens is you all of a sudden face cash flow issues because you can't make payroll next month. And then you're in the negative spiral of having to kind of get back to where you were. So I think it starts with having a process to actually review the numbers. And then understanding and making sure you're focused on the right one. So lots of business owners just focus on revenue. They think growth equals more revenue. And that may be true, and it is true for a lot of businesses, but if you double your revenue but you halve your profit margins, you end up with the same amount of profit. Mm. So was it really worth doubling the business and taking on all that additional stress? And the hardest part of any business is to get clients. So the hardest thing to do most of the time is going to be to get new clients to grow revenue. Mm. But if you're going to do that at a lower profit margin, then you sort of need to know what it's going to cost you.
Yeah, and whether it's really worth it.
Exactly.
It's the vanity sanity old adage that's overused. But would you say that's a key blind spot that exists in lots of kind of fast growth entrepreneurs, or are there other blind spots that you could speak to that you come across often?
I'd say that is a main one, and really having an understanding of what is driving the profit margins. So understanding firstly what the profit margins are, what should they be, what's the norm for that particular sector, and then understanding why we're on track or off track, and then using that to kind of drive your decision making. And it doesn't mean going in and slashing a load of costs, but it means perhaps, because you can only cut costs to a certain degree, at some point cutting costs leads to reducing the potential growth of the business.
Or worse,
exactly, yeah. But if you can focus on driving efficiency, and then once you're comfortable with the level of efficiency that you're operating at, then you focus on generating more revenue, then I think that's a more healthy way to do things. And I'm speaking in general terms. Obviously, every business is completely different, and it does differ across sectors, but as a general theme.
Well, while we're generalizing, let's look at some general statistics, shall we? Yeah. And we're all aware that something like 80% of companies ultimately fail in the first 5 years of their existence, which is a real sad indictment of how hard it is to build a material, growing business. But I think you've mentioned to me in previous conversations that about 82% of those that fail are failing because sometimes self-inflicted cash flow issues.
Yeah.
Could you speak to perhaps why that is the case?
Yeah, so I think what it comes down to is really business owners focusing on the wrong thing. So they're not focusing on preserving cash and not running out of cash. They're focused on, it could be top line revenue, or it could be growth, whatever growth means to the business owner. But the bottom line is that cash is what keeps all businesses alive. Mm. And a lack of cash will cause any business to go bust. You can get cash from three places for any business. It either comes from debt, the business borrowing money, and debt can keep the business going for a long time. If you look at what happened in COVID, the government gave out loans to people, to lots of businesses, and kept them alive when actually they would have gone out of business if left to their own devices. On the other hand, you've got owner investments. Lots of businesses run based on external investment for years and years and years before ever turning a profit.
Yeah.
But at some point, both debt and external investment, they're unsustainable.
Sure.
So what we need to do is we need to focus on the third source of any business's source of cash, which is the business. So we need to get the business good at generating cash, i.e. consistent positive cash flow. And once we focus on generating consistent positive cash flow, everything else just becomes a lot easier. I'm not saying it's easy to generate consistent positive cash flow, but if we know that our focus is on that, then we can kind of say no to the other noise.
And the fundamentals that drive that particular silver bullet, the self-generated, strong, recurring cash flow, that's coming from their business model, it's coming from an understanding of their cost to serve. What other things should an entrepreneur be kind of scrutinizing in order to really maximize that cash generative nature of their business?
So what I like to do is break the business into, you can really break it down into as many as you want, but I go for 16 drivers. So fundamentally, it's the critical four, so revenue, gross profit, net profit, cash, and then they break out into more drivers. So those drivers apply to any business, doesn't matter what size business or what sector, same drivers apply. And so it's really understanding the pyramid. So you've got revenue at the top, gross profit, net profit, and cash at the bottom. If your goal is to optimize for cash flow, the one at the bottom, if that number isn't where you want it to be, then the cause of it is that one of the other drivers that are driving that further up the pyramid is not where you need to be.
Yeah.
So if you've got zero leads coming in, then naturally everything else is going to be zero. Mm-hmm. If your gross profit margin is zero, then naturally everything else below that's going to be zero. So what I do is I get clear on those 16 drivers. We track those 16 drivers every month, and then we can identify which ones are not where we want them to be by setting a target for each one. And that way we can make sure that our focus is going to be on the drivers that are going to have the biggest impact in profits and cash flow every month. So, for example, if you break the 16 drivers down and you identify that actually the main thing that's stopping our cash flow from being at the level it needs to be is that we're taking too long to collect our cash. We're taking 60 days instead of 30 days, which is the industry norm. So for the next 30 days, all we're going to focus on doing is collecting the cash that we're owed and making sure that our customers pay us within 30 days. And by repeating that process every month and focusing on the number one or two drivers, they're going to have the biggest impact on that bottom number naturally. And by definition, you will end up in a much healthier place. Doesn't mean it's quick and it doesn't mean it's easy, but your focus is then more focused.
Yeah, some of those quick and easy things that the entrepreneur may have got into the habit of, though, like underpricing and not chasing, overdue debts and things like that. You know, those aren't necessarily easy to dig yourself out of. That will take time to sort of almost change the culture of the way you're dealing with your customers, right? But yeah, really interesting that your process goes all the way to like top of funnel. You know, what are you doing about sourcing, you know, leads, converting those leads, making sure you make money out of those leads, right the way through to how that then impacts the bottom line with all of the various overheads and cost to serve along the way. That's really, you know, a great kind of toolkit, I imagine, for entrepreneurs. Talk to me a bit about what you've termed in the past messy books. And I think that conjures up lots of iconography and visions in someone like, from the finance world's mind. But like, give us some examples of where you've seen real, truly messy books.
Yeah, so I could probably talk quite a long time on this, but I think what it comes down to is when you open the books, you pull out the three financial statements, profit and loss, balance sheet, cash flow forecast, and things don't tell a story that reflects reality. Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to. Now, that could be poor
bookkeeping. Isn't that creative accounting?
It could be poor bookkeeping. It could be stuff that's been registered in the wrong place. Or it could be that the books just aren't in an appropriate format where you can't view, let's say, gross profit across different product lines. So you can't actually see how much money you're making on each product. Or you might have, you know, payroll bundled in with other costs, and therefore you can't break out how much you're actually spending on payroll every month.
So it's a good granular general ledger then that allows you to get into each account and work out, you know, where your expenditure is going and where your revenue is coming from. You know, more depth of that taxonomy is better.
Generally, I would say more depth is better. Yeah, having a competent bookkeeper is step number one. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that any business owner should be doing this themselves. The business owner's job is to run the business, and naturally, that doesn't mean going through the bookkeeping.
I should think many of them will be pleased to hear that.
Yeah.
But that's where they need folks like you to put them on the straight and narrow. Now, you mentioned bookkeeping. That's not something that you necessarily get stuck into. I think you set the rules and the sort of framework and, you know, help them find the right people. But I doubt that you're going back to a bookkeeping role for your clients.
Yeah. So what I support with is the strategy piece. So I'll take all of the data, all of the financials, and then I'll help them look forward. Mm-hmm. So how do we identify what's working and what's not working in the business? And then how do we identify what to focus on? And then what actually do we need to do to actually improve that number? And that's what I work on with the business owners. It's very much a forward-looking strategy. So we'll start with their goals. We'll think 3 to 5 years away, what do you really want to do here? Do you want to sell the business? Do you want to work one day a week from Spain? Whatever it may be. Reverse engineer that back to what profits and cash flow need to look like in order to deliver that goal. Mm-hmm. And then turn that into a one-year target. So that if we achieve the target this year, we're on track to the three-year target. And then we break the business up into those 16 drivers, work out what's not where it needs to be, and then that's how we drive the decision-making and the focus. And then together with the business owner, we come up with what specifically each person in the team is going to do to get the business moving in the right direction. So to answer your question, yeah, I don't do the bookkeeping, but I will support the owner in making sure they've got a competent bookkeeper and accountant.
Yeah, and that they're disciplined, I guess, because yeah. A lot of entrepreneurs are running their books retrospectively and sort of reconciling after the fact. And I've had a look at a couple of M&A opportunities recently where we got into the due diligence. And frankly, you know, there's a lot of, oh, well, this is the record of what happened, rather than using Xero or QuickBooks as something to help with forecasting. At which sort of size of a business should you think they should start doing things like accruing and providing in their accounts to give them that sort of perspective on the future and smooth out the pits and troughs?
I think so. What I usually say to my clients, very often I'll be at the early stages of working with them and they'll say, oh, well, we can't start working together because the books aren't ready. And I think what it comes down to is the numbers need to be directionally accurate, because if I said no to every client that doesn't have perfect books, then I wouldn't have any clients. But also the clients that I have worked with wouldn't have had the help that they needed. So regardless of whether the books are tidy or not, the business owner still needs help. If you look at every business that's failed, many of them had messy books, many of them didn't. They all had a bookkeeper. That's not the determinant as to whether a business is going to succeed or not. Mm.
But it's one part of the story.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But having some way to gauge what's working, what's not working, that's important. Okay. If we can start with directionally accurate books, then we can get a bookkeeper in the right position, and we can build it from there.
Yeah, exactly. It's the old adage of when's the right time to plant a tree? Well, you know, 20 years ago. Yeah. But actually, if you didn't do it then, do it now and start as you mean to go on, because you know, you're now setting the framework for a different kind of future. This is an M&A podcast. Let's turn to some of your experience with M&A. I think you supported an IT support business in its sale, specifically by helping them get their finances in order before marketing the business for sale took place, which is obviously very smart, listeners. Could you walk us through what that preparation process involved and how it directly contributed to a better due diligence and successful sale?
Yeah. So I started working with them about 3 months before the business was marketed.
Well, that's quite late then.
It is quite late. So what I was going to say was, ideally, it would be best to get the support you need much earlier than that, a few years at least. If the business actually needs to improve their profits and cash flow, then you'd want to be even earlier than that. But fundamentally, to get the business ready from a due diligence perspective, then yeah, as early as possible is better. But anyway, 3 months before, step number one was to get the business ready for marketing, which means creating an information memorandum, highlighting what's going on in the business. So I was supporting with getting that information and making sure that the financials were in a position where we could pull the information that we needed. And the information that we needed was to be able to see gross profit by product, to have a forecast in place for the next few years, and to start getting the data room ready so that when we did get to that due diligence phase of the process, once we had a buyer, then the business owner having to go around and find all these documents that the potential buyer needed wouldn't delay the process and cause the whole thing to fall through. So that was kind of the earlier stages of it. Then once the marketing took place, it was actually pretty quick to find a potential buyer. Then heads of terms was agreed, and then we went into the due diligence process. Due diligence process meant we were provided with a big due diligence list, so financial, tax, legal, operational, and my job was to basically get all of this information from the business owner. Mm. So we got as much as we could prior to actually getting to that stage so that it didn't delay the process, because a lot of this stuff can be incredibly overwhelming for a business owner to have to go and find, because you're sure. Giving them a list of all of these things which may or may not exist somewhere in their filing system.
So this team sensibly made that your problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it was my problem. And that also meant making sure the financials all stacked up as well, which was a key part of it.
Yeah, so let's get into that. Exit preparation accounting, you know, the old adjusted EBITDA. Now in this, you're working for the home team in this case, so you're looking to try and make their numbers look as good as possible. How creative do you think sellers should be in, acceptable ad-backs and, really kind of swelling that adjusted EBITDA, going from their tax-mitigated accounts that are sort of like what they filed to what they'd like to optimize for multiple enterprise value?
I think as a general rule of thumb, you should, in the years leading up to your sale, you should run the business as if someone were going to buy it tomorrow with no ad backs. That's the easiest way to run it, because the more ad backs that you have, then the more you're going to have a back and forth with any potential buyer and justify why they shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. And if they shouldn't be there, then really they shouldn't be there. If they're not going to be there when the new owner takes over the business, then they shouldn't be there in the first place. That would be the justification of a buyer.
So the short term benefit of putting the wife on the business class flights while you're both traveling to, Dubai for business. Yeah. Or small cash loan for your new conservatory and that kind of stuff. Those are things you probably are going to trip yourself up with, right?
Not a good idea, because the more you start putting things like that through the business, the more you have to have that back and forth with the client. And that breaks down the trust. And a big part of any acquisition for small businesses is trust.
Well, I've seen situations where buyers are being told by sellers, trust me. Yes, I've done some creative things in order to, mislead HMRC, but you can trust me. I'm fully legit. I think it's difficult to have those two sides to the coin and maybe have a credible conversation around acquisition and at least maximize your exit value, right? Because I think all of that comes with a risk, and that, you know, reduces the premium that someone's willing to pay for your business.
Yeah, I agree. And I think as a general rule of thumb, a basic salary for the director, you know, the tax-free minimum plus pension contributions, I think that's fine. And most buyers are okay with that. But when you start getting into really personal expenses going through the business, then you start getting into territory that could cause deals to break through.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any other financial considerations or preparations that also get overlooked by sellers in preparing for that process? I mean, okay, they've got tidy books and they've maybe stopped doing some of the kind of lifestyle things that would be having a long-term consequence. But are there any other sort of, you know, things that get overlooked or missed?
So I think we can touch on a few other general points. So the business needs to run without the business owner, mm-hmm. and the business owner needs to be able to demonstrate that. So they need to be able to demonstrate that business will carry on coming in to the business without the business owner there, i.e. not all the client relationships are fully dependent on the business owner, so that when somebody buys it and the business owner steps aside, that business is going to carry on operating. Business is going to carry on coming in. That's number one. Number two, not too much exposure to any few clients. So if you've got a few...
Customer concentration. Yeah. Big red flag, isn't it?
Exactly. So if you've got a few clients that generate more than a significant chunk of your revenue, that's a red flag to a potential buyer, because that client could pull the plug at any given point.
What's the safe threshold there, would you say? I mean, I tend to look for this sort of like, give me your top 10 customers, and if that is, you know, accounting for, you know, 70% of your revenue, then I probably got a bit of a concentration risk there. But am I being overzealous with that?
I would do the same. I would do the same. Again, it's hard to apply one rule to all businesses, because if those 10 clients have got 5-year contracts, then that's a different scenario, yeah, to have all of those clients being on 30-day contracts. So I think it's a case of looking at the contracts, looking at what is going on with each of them, looking at the contracts and finding out how sticky the model is.
So you don't have to be super diversified then as a business in terms of your customer base in order to still be a sort of acquirable entity, as long as you've got some robustness in the way that you're doing business with your key customers and that you know that they're locked in. Selling the business at the point where all of your top customers are coming around for their contract renewal is maybe not the most likely outcome. Is not going to get you a very high value for the business, is it? But if you've just locked them all in, maybe then's a good milestone to start chopping the business around.
Exactly. And I think a key part of it is to think of it through the buyer's lens. So essentially the buyer wants to buy something that's going to carry on operating once they acquire it. And if things are going to start falling apart, what the day that they acquire it, customers are going to leave, the gross profit's going to all of a sudden start dropping, then that's a risk. And you as the buyer need to understand that that is how they're going to view this business. It's as an asset. And how much risk does this asset carry? And the more risk it carries, the less they're going to pay for it, or the less they're going to be willing to pay for it.
Yeah. What about poacher turned gamekeeper sort of scenarios? Do you work for the away team as well? Have you done any work in terms of due diligence, commercial and financial due diligence for acquirers?
I've done a few bits and pieces over the years, yeah. So I've done a bit of that, yeah. So financial due diligence, the same on the other side of the table, really. So it's going through that data room and then understanding kind of what's going on in terms of trends, checking that everything that the seller is saying checks out, justifying to the buyer whether they should move forward with the deal.
Because I feel that having experience on both sides of the transaction is a superpower, because you are able to bring what you know to be the mindset of one party to the way you prepare the other party, right?
Yeah.
And you can obviously represent both sides of one transaction, but I feel like it's a lawyer to some extent. You know, you can quite comfortably and professionally represent a client regardless of which chair they're sitting in, which side of the table they're on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other point that I just want to mention is the forecast. The forecast needs to check out. So you can't have a forecast that says you're going to double the business over the next year.
Well, how much weight do you think is okay to place on a forecast? I mean, I've worked with some clients who are trying to use, for example, discounted cash flow valuation that is heavily anchored on, well, we're going to suddenly materialize 40% per annum, you know, growth here. And it's like, well, for the last 5 years, that hasn't happened. You know, what's going to change post the sale of the company? I mean, discounted cash flow valuations are useful instruments for increasing, like using future potential to increase today's value. But surely people are buying based on proven cash flow.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Again, depends on the sector. you know, some of these tech businesses.
Software multiples. Although I'm sure that only serves venture capital.
For the businesses that, even though we haven't said it, I believe we're talking about here, it's generally, sub 15, 20 mil revenue, owner operated.
Yeah, traditional business.
Exactly. Yeah. Generally you're going to be able to need to demonstrate that the profits have been solid and consistent for 2 to 3 years at least. But the forecast does hold weight. And the point that I was going to make was, if you're magically claiming that the business is going to double over the next year, you really need to be able to justify it. I don't think that would necessarily come into the valuation of the amount that you're going to get on day one, but it could result in an earnout if that materializes.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe pipeline then, if someone's got a real crystal pipeline as regards, we've got high confidence in our CRM, you know, we've qualified that these transactions are going to crystallize on this date, and we've got, you know, an agreement in principle. Is that the sort of thing that you can take to the bank in a transaction? Or
I think it could result in the earnout payout being higher, but not necessarily the amount you're going to get on day one. And the other thing with the forecast is that it just shows the buyer that you've thought about it, and that you're not just saying, you know, because if I just said to you, here are the numbers, this is what we did for the last 3 years, here are our accounts, then the buyer's like, okay, great, well, what's going to happen next? And even if it's going to just carry on increasing by inflation or maybe going down 5%, it just means that you've thought about it and you put something down on paper.
Well, your mind's not already out the door. Yeah,
exactly.
You don't think this is the end of the story for the company. So yeah. I think having a plan, having a forecast is probably an important part of preparing the business for sale, because you're wanting to give confidence to the buyer that there is a future for the business and that you're not just cashing out because you know it's peaked and it's on the decline and
exactly.
You hospital pass to somebody else. I take your point that having a forecast is important, but I don't necessarily think that from a buyer's perspective, they would attach much weight to things that are more than a year, 18 months out into the future.
I would agree with that. In terms of the business evaluation, yeah, it's not going to hold a huge amount of weight, but just important to have because it shows that you've thought about it. And also things like upcoming expenses, like for example, this particular one that I helped exit, they needed to invest 30, 40 grand into their office refurbishment and things like that. And so, you know, the buyer would visit the property and be like, well, clearly some work needs to be done here. Where's that in your forecast?
All right. So encouraging the seller to own that problem. Like, yes, we have earmarks, you know, depreciation has accounted for these assets, and we know that we're going to have to, you know, call on the cash to go and replace them.
Exactly.
Yeah, really good. I like that. Look, you're talking about earnouts, as I do, like a fait accompli, like they, you know, they're obvious and, prerequisite part of a transaction these days. And that's certainly what we're seeing at BizCrunch is, you know, there's no such thing really as a deal of 100% cash up front anymore. I think we've inherited the Americanized model of at least deferred consideration because it becomes part of the leverage of the transaction. But also if you can attach a conditionality to that deferred consideration with financial performance KPIs, then, you know, all the better for the buyer, right? But how have you seen that play out with sellers? I mean, do you give any of your seller clients advice around when it's a good idea to take an earnout and when it isn't?
So yes is the answer. They're definitely very popular. Again, from the buyer's perspective, they want to buy something and take as little risk as possible. From the seller's perspective, they want to get 100% on day one. Obviously, that's not realistic nowadays, or not sure if it ever was. But part of that could be, you know, deferred consideration that isn't contingent on any performance goal, and it could be contingent on performance goal, which would then be an earnout. So I've seen them based on revenue, gross profit, a variety of different variable factors. And I think the key is to work out, well, from the buyer's perspective, what can't be manipulated. And then from the seller's perspective, obviously they want to make sure that they get the deferred consideration. So what can they do that's going to maximize the chance of that? And it does sometimes come down to really the wording, the way it's worded in the share purchase agreement.
Sure, that manipulation thing I think runs both ways because as a seller, you've handed over the keys to the door. Someone else is running the show, setting the policy. You know, could they make a decision? And normally there's clauses in the SPA to prevent this during an earnout period. But could the buyer make a decision that reduces the performance of the business so that they don't end up paying the earnout element? Seen that happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do businesses usually come to the conclusion that they need your services? I mean, we've talked about some of these compelling milestones where they're, you know, thinking about acquiring or thinking about selling. And aside from your like outreach and your, because you're increasingly visible, I know, and you're obviously appearing on lots of these podcasts, etc., and you're on your own. How are your clients usually discovering and realizing they need you?
I think it's quite a personal thing. It's a personalized individual service, and it's relationship based. So it's not like people decide they need to buy, you know, something generic, and they Google it and go and buy it. It's a relationship based service, and so it's usually through, you know, appearing on a podcast or something like this. I say something that resonates with the business owner who hears it, or it's going to an event, you know, having a chat with someone, saying something that just rings true with them. Usually it comes back to somewhere along the lines of just not really having a solid grasp of what the financials are doing in their own business. Mm. They might not be a complete mess, but perhaps they realize that they don't review the numbers in the way that they should. Maybe they've had someone run their accounts or you know, doing their books for the last 20 years, and they're wondering whether that person is actually adding much or doing what they should be doing. Sure. They know that they're not providing any forward-looking guidance, but is there something that can be improved in that process?
But these entrepreneurs aren't necessarily waking up in a cold sweat one morning going, my bookkeeping's crap. I think there's, like you see with commercial finance, like there's a compelling moment of, you know, or as I like to call it, an oh shit moment, yeah. Whereby they have a, you know, an impairment, or they have something that some headwind that makes them have a rethink about is the status quo really working for me, and go and try and fix it. And are you finding a disproportionate number of potential clients are in a sort of adverse conditions where they need help to turn something around? Or are you seeing, I hope is the case, entrepreneurs that are forward thinking and going, well, yeah, we're growing up as a business and we need some professionalism here?
To be honest, it's kind of a mixture of both.
Right.
Yeah, you have the ones who are struggling and need help. They know they need help. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the ones who are really profitable. They're doing really well. They've got loads of cash in the bank, and they just want to know how to grow to the next level. Mm. And they're kind of humble in that they know that they're not a financial expert. They're an expert at what they do. They're an expert at their trade or their craft, but they're not a numbers person. And so understanding profits and cash flow isn't something that necessarily comes naturally to them. And so they want someone like me to just come in and just guide them every month, help them see what's working, what's not working, and then help them make those data-driven decisions on the most important things. And then naturally that feeds into things like acquisitions. Do we grow organically or do we grow through acquisitions? And how are we going to get this thing ready for sale?
I'm glad to hear that, that you've got a mix of potential clients coming to you with different challenges and different opportunities. Yours and your team's time as professionals, you know, are limited. You know, you've got to serve existing customers, and you know, taking on new clients, I guess it has to be where you feel you can add value, and also where you feel that there is a good fit between those clients. Are there any particular filters that you apply to sort of determine whether you might be able to assist?
I think I just work out if the business owner is someone that I want to work with. It really comes down to that.
The human factor, yeah. Again.
Are they going to take action? Because there's nothing more frustrating than having these calls. You know, you agree what needs to be done. The business owner's in agreement that, you know, that needs to be done. And then you get to the next call, nothing's happened. And it's frustrating. And so, yeah, I really enjoy working with the business owners that they just take action. They just do it.
So a bias for action, trustworthiness, coachability, you know, those kind of
exactly
fundamentals that mark out the successful entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is a relationship thing. So I'll obviously meet them in person and, you know, we'll spend time together, go for lunch or whatever before or after our meeting. And it's much makes the job a lot more enjoyable, and actually the clients get much better results when that's an enjoyable, yeah, tension-free experience.
Well, very well said. Yeah, they have to trust their professional service providers and be open and open-minded as well. So that's great. Super. Well, how do potential clients contact you? How do they find you? Where do they need to go to learn more about Synergy CFO Solutions?
So nice and simple. I'm on LinkedIn. Drop me a message on LinkedIn or connect with me. I've also got a number of free resources that I can provide you links to. Some PDFs that basically explain those 16 drivers that I talked about, how to measure them, how to track them, and then how to make decisions based off them. So yeah, my exact process, just given to you.
Fabulous. Well, Giving without expectation to receive. How refreshing. That's nice, Tom. And I'm sure you'll be inundated with listeners and viewers that might want to avail themselves of those assets, those tools. And we'll put, obviously, a link to Tom's contact information and Synergy CFO Solutions website, etc., into the show notes today. So, Tom, I just want to really kind of give you the opportunity to, you know, make any takeaways, deliver any takeaways that you'd like listeners or viewers to leave this experience with. Any pearls of wisdom to impart?
I would just say, for any business owner, if you're not tracking your numbers every month with some sort of simple to follow system, then I would recommend just getting started. You can start with the critical four that I mentioned: revenue, gross profit, net profit, cash. Just track them every month. Just look what's happening month to month. And then over time, you're going to start seeing trends. And then from those trends, you can start making decisions. And then when you're making those data-driven decisions and you're focused on the most important things in the business, then naturally everything else is going to improve. It's much better doing that than it is making decisions based off how much is in the bank account. Yeah. So if anything I've said has resonated with you, then by all means, grab a copy of the training that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and welcome to reach out and have a chat with anyone who wants to have a chat.
Magic.
But yeah, thank you very much for having me, Gareth. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing all about how your business serves the important and often overlooked part of our economy, these small and medium businesses in that growth stage where there's an opportunity for them to continue to contribute to the economic success of the UK and beyond. I really think that the sort of financial and practical insights that you've shared today have been very valuable, and I'm sure you'll see that in the comments. Understanding your numbers is clearly fundamental to the success of any business, and we can't stress enough at BizCrunch that the path to a smooth exit involves having good financial professionals on your team to ensure that your accounts are in good order, because you won't survive the first pass of a due diligence if there are messy books, as we talked about earlier. So great. Well, listeners, viewers, thanks so much for tuning in today. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. Tune in next time for another episode with another interview from the community. And until then, do keep on crunching. Bye for now.